The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, September 13th through the 24th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:17, Wednesday, September 1st. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And because of that stellar Saturday of racing, I'm going to try my hardest to be Mr. Positive today. We'll see how long that lasts.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
That's it, Bill? That's all you're giving us today?
Yeah, with my voice, I didn't think I could go much further, John.
Oh, he doesn't get paid by the word, John.
I guess so. All right. Well, Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and I'm glad everyone got the memo of the monochrome rainy day attire. I think we're, various shades of gray and black.
Yeah, I usually try to wear bright colors on rainy days. I guess I forgot this time.
I know. Well, thank God we have upbeat Bill Finley to carry us through.
And Mr. Positive over here. Watch. Just you watch. Yeah. So like I said, I am going to solemnly swear to be Mr. Positive this show. As positive as you've ever seen me. Unless some PR nightmare breaks between now and when we wrap, which is a distinct possibility. Now, I will be the pom-pom waver today, this morning. And it's because of what we saw on that racetrack Saturday at Saratoga. It was the kind of day that reminds you why you continue to love and care about this game despite all of its warts. And, I actually barely bet, in part because I thought the stakes looked kind of chalky, which it ended up being. So it wasn't a great day for bettors, but for fans, it allowed me to enjoy the race, just enjoy the races as a fan from that point of view. And that made it even better for me, honestly, because that's the way I got into this game, was being a fan before I was betting on the horses. And, you got to start with the Travers and just an absolutely scintillating stretch battle between Essential Quality and Midnight Bourbon. And, we've said this before that Essential Quality doesn't often win by a lot, but he just finds a way to get the job done. He's tractable. He can adapt to different pace scenarios. And I think it helps a lot that he has a jockey in Luis Saez who understands the value of early position. You hardly ever see him grab horses and take horses back. If he ever does, you can be sure that it was a trainer's instruction. And he did that with Essential Quality once again. He got him into the race. It was a race that lacked speed on paper. He got right up alongside of Midnight Bourbon, and he was able to keep that one in his sights the entire way. And they just threw down in an epic stretch battle. And it's, I don't want to slight Midnight Bourbon because I thought he ran really, really well. And it's nice to see him bounce back from that basically near tragedy in the Haskell and be able to, fight back and run so well in the Travers. But it just never seemed like Essential Quality was going to lose that race. And I think it's because we know him by now, and we know that he just battles and battles and battles and always has that extra bit to give to get up at the wire. And it was just a phenomenal race, and it was a phenomenal race card. We're going to get to all the stakes action. A lot of the show is going to be recapping Saturday because of what a special day it was. But I thought the Travers was the perfect capper to that day. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, I completely agree. Please excuse my voice, folks. I'm battling a late summer cold here. I'll do the best I can. Essential Quality is what you expect of him. He gives you what he's going to give you. That's going to be 9 times out of 10, or in his case, 8 times out of 9, because he's 8 for 9 in his career, a win. Now, again, you look at the final margin of victory and you say he didn't, once again, he, outfought another horse. He didn't blow anybody away, but I think you got to consider that running down Midnight Bourbon, who's a very good horse, was not going to be an easy thing to do. Midnight Bourbon had everything on his own way right through the early portion of the race. The fractions were modest. Nobody was going after him. And I agree with you. Saez was very confident. He knew he didn't have to go after Midnight Bourbon right away. He knew he could save some horse, make that run in the stretch, and likely get by Midnight Bourbon. So I think even though he won by a relatively narrow margin, I think the race, all things considered, is even better than it looks on paper. And it was also interesting, I forget who it was, somebody, maybe it was a listener or somebody, chastised me for calling Essential Quality a grinder. The race was over, and what did Brad Cox call him? A grinder. Thank you. Okay. He is a grinder. And again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And the other thing too, I think he's clinched the three-row championship at this point. I mean, you know, maybe something could happen in the Breeders' Cup Classic, but right now he's got the Travers Jim Dandy Belmont Bluegrass in the Southwest Stakes. He's clearly the best three-year-old out there, and I look forward to a possible Horse of the Year showdown with him and Nick's Go, stablemates in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
The other thing that stood out to me in this race, aside from the fact that Essential Quality and Midnight Bourbon are just top quality horses. I mean, that's not saying anything that's outrageous. Is just what a good job both riders did, Saez and Santana, in giving their horse respective mounts the best possible chance to win. And you look at Midnight Bourbon, and they went a very pedestrian 24, 48 and 4, 114 and 2 for 6 furlongs. And when you compare that to, you know, to the personal ensign, albeit, you know, the fillies versus the colts. But, you know, you look at that race, Latruska was 23, 46 and 3, 110 and 3, and, you know, had a mile at 136. The mile marker for the Run Happy Travers was 138 and 4. So, you know, Santana did everything he possibly could to get Midnight Bourbon, you know, slowed down, relaxed, and in a position to win. And then it was just the two of them, Essential Quality and Midnight Bourbon, you know, going tooth and nail. And they finished up in 23 flat. I mean, that's really impressive for a mile and a quarter race. You know, grade one, for them to finish in 23, you know, was just outstanding. And to me, that was the takeaway for me, was watching them go head to head from really, you know, into the turn at the top of the stretch all the way down the stretch. And they just both accelerated. I mean, it was just really amazing how quickly they went, going a mile and a quarter, the last quarter mile in 23 flat. So for me, that was the takeaway. And I think we're going to be looking back at Midnight Bourbon, you know, years from now, and we're going to be like, boy, he was just unlucky to be in a field that included Essential Quality and the likes, because, you know, this three-year-old crop, I know we've kind of gone back and forth, but they've actually risen to the occasion. I mean, there've been a lot of really good ones. And if there wasn't an Essential Quality, how good would we be talking about, or would be talking about how good Midnight Bourbon is and Keep Me in Mind and some of these other horses that just continually, you know, run up against Essential Quality, who, you know, like you mentioned, Bill, is obviously risen to the top of the heap for the three-year-old crop. But man, this was a really impressive race on a lot of levels, and exciting way to you know, to finish up, I guess, the fifth out of 6 grade ones at Saratoga.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad you brought up the fractions, because that to me was one of the most interesting parts of the race. And it was to the point where I thought those fractions were going to get corrected, because it didn't pass the smell test that they went, you know, 25 and a half seconds for the third quarter and then came home in 23 and change. I've never seen a mile and a quarter dirt race where they come home in 23.15 seconds. Like, that is absolutely remarkable. And the fractions have not been corrected. They're still up like that. And not to be critical, but I think that, you know, looking back on that, if those fractions are right, I think the other riders kind of screwed up not moving into that third quarter, because it seems like that was the time to go get those two horses, and everyone else was still kind of waiting and waiting and waiting. But yeah, so once those two had it to themselves for the final quarter, you know, I mean, that was kind of predictable with the way those fractions went up, but they both just ran outstanding races. And I think it's a good point that John makes, that, you know, it's kind of like the same thing with Hot Rod Charlie's run in the Belmont. Like, if Essential Quality wasn't in that race, we would be talking about Hot Rod Charlie running one of the greatest Belmonts relative to circumstance of all time. You know, but he kind of gets forgotten a little bit because he was second. Like, just the same way in this race, if Essential Quality wasn't in the race and Midnight Bourbon finished up in 23 and change, we would be saying, like, this is one of the all-time great Travers performances in terms of the way he finished up. So I do agree that this has proven to be a very nice three-year-old class, and Essential Quality has had to really work to get himself to the top of this division. He's had to bust his ass to win the Belmont and the Travers and the Jim Dandy and the Bluegrass. None of these races were easy for him, but he just proved that he has a will to win. And I know, and I think that people overstate that sometimes in racing. I think, you know, horses basically just kind of do what they were able to do and nothing more and nothing less. But I think some of them do have that kind of mind where they know how to keep themselves in front as the wire comes. And I think he's one of those horses, and he's super special. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how Brad Cox manages him and Nick's Go the rest of the year. Obviously, you would assume that they're going to meet in the Classic, but you would think that they're going to have maybe one more race in between. And I think we're down to three horses now for Horse of the Year: Central Quality, Nick's Go, and Latruska. And it's really going to be fun down the stretch to see what the three of them do, because they're all extremely admirable horses. Just to move on from the Travers, we got to talk about the Alan Jerkins, because I'm already claiming that race as my race of the year for the year end show, because I don't know how you could possibly top that. You know, going into the race, it was, you know, what maybe the most marquee matchup of 3-year-old sprinters you could possibly imagine. Jackie's Warrior, we all know, is extremely special. And then, you know, I was just a little disappointed the way Following Sea ran. I expected him to run better than that. But Life Is Good coming back off that layoff, and just the hype that surrounded him, and also the controversy that surrounded him with Bob Baffert. You know, I thought he was a terrible, terrible favorite coming off the layoff in that kind of field. Even though he lost, he kind of proved me wrong, because he just ran such a great race. He did get cost a little bit by drifting out, as he usually does. And Joel Rosario was very smart to stay on the rail and wait for him to come out so he could slip inside of him. But what a battle in the stretch. They finished up. They ran 121.3. They both got 107 buyers. I think I tweeted it after the race, but I don't think you're ever going to see two better 3-year-old sprinters throw down like that. And it was just marvelous to watch. And it was probably even better to watch on track, because that was super, super special. And those are both two very, very admirable horses. You know, Jackie's Warrior has already got the stud deal. I wonder if he's going to be back at four. It'd be great if he was, probably not. Life Is Good, I'm not aware of any stud deals so far. I think he's still got a little bit more to prove. So maybe we'll see him next year. But either way, you had to appreciate that battle in the stretch between just two absolutely brilliant horses. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, Joe, I couldn't agree more. And I think you talked about a lot about Life Is Good, who ran, obviously, a tremendous race. And also, the odds you're talking about, that he was a bad favorite. He was not the morning line favorite. Jackie's Warrior was. So that was a little bit of a surprise there. But look at Jackie's Warrior, what this horse has done. Once they figured out that he's a one-term sprinter, I mean, he is just nails every single time out. He is so fast. He is so good. And, you know, he did have a good trip because the rail opened up the way it did. I was a little surprised Life Is Good went to the lead. I thought Jackie's Warrior would go to the lead, but that wasn't anything that I think really had a major say in the outcome of the race. But, you know, he had to get by, you know, a horse that some of us after the San Felipe were saying is not only the Derby winner, but a potential Triple Crown horse. Now, that all, you know, turned around when he had to be sidelined. I'm sure at this point in the year, they had hoped to be in races like the Travers and not in the Alan Jerkins, because, you know, this looked like a two-turn horse. But I mean, Jackie's Warrior is so good and so fast and has been so well managed by Steve Asmussen. And again, we talked about the showdown between Nick's Go and Essential Quality, two stablemates in the Breeders' Cup Classic. And I know we'll get to the forego, but we could see a showdown for the sprint title between Stable Matt's Yalpan and Jackie's Warrior in the Breeders' Cup Sprint. But I couldn't agree more. Usually races like that never live up to the hype. You know, somebody doesn't run. Somebody just goes out and wins by six lengths, something like that. It lived up to the hype. A-plus performance for both horses, but maybe an A++ for Jackie's Warrior.
I think either horse could have won, and we wouldn't have been surprised at this point. They both fought hard. They both went down the stretch. You know, I think that Rosario did just enough to get his horse up in front by staying on the rail. I think that was a brilliant move, knowing that Life Is Good has a history of you know, meandering and wandering out on the turn. And he just took it. I mean, it's not easy to do when you're going that fast, when you're going 21-4, 44 flat, and then to cut the corner like he did, shows not only how much confidence he had in the horse, but also what an athlete Jackie's Warrior is to be able to go that fast and hug the rail the way he did. These aren't machines, and you have to understand physics. And it, you know, it's amazing that he's that athletic to be able to corner the way that he does. He does corner like a Lamborghini. I mean, it's just amazing the way Jackie's Warrior can handle that kind of speed. But Life Is Good, you really have to, you know, congratulate, because here's a horse that not only was coming off a 5-month layoff, had to go cross country to Saratoga to, you know, to train, change trainers, and then still fought off as hard as he could probably the top three-year-old sprinter in the country. And, you know, life is good. I'm really curious to see now where they're pointing him for. Are they going to go to the sprints, the Breeders' Cup sprint, or are they going to go for the Breeders' Cup mile? Because either way, you could make a strong case that he is, you know, one of the top, if not the top three-year-old contender in either division, depending on where he goes. But I was really impressed, Joe. I think you're right. It's probably the, you know, one of the races of the year, if not the race of the year so far, because they did live up to the hype and because those two horses were just so outstanding. You know, from the word go, they were just outstanding all the way through. And, you know, obviously, life is good. I think the reason why they don't have a announced stud, deal yet is because he is co-owned by Windstar. So I'm sure they're going to keep him in house. You know, the day that he retires is the day that they're going to be able to get 200 mares to him, because he's just, you know, son of into mischief and that explosive, and can carry his speed to go a mile and a mile 16th. He's going to be well sought after in the breeding shed once his illustrious career is done.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point about Windstar. I should have assumed that he's going to stand there, but yeah, just to Bill's point about, you know, the way he was managed, I got to give a lot of credit to Kirk Robinson, who I know was probably watching the show. So congratulations, friend of the show. You know, I spoke to him after the Southwest, and even before the Southwest, going back to last year when we had him on the show, he was realistic. He said, you know, this horse with his pedigree, probably not going to want to go a mile and a quarter. Now he had to give him a shot with how brilliant he was in his 2-year-old year, winning the Champagne at a mile, and certainly did not run badly, I thought, in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, considering the pace. But he was always realistic and gave him a shot in the Southwest. He didn't run well. He got an easy lead. He backed up. He finished a well-beaten third. And he immediately was like, we're not going to push forward on the Derby trail. I'm going to trust Steve to turn this horse back. And now look what they got. They have possibly a champion male sprinter as a 3-year-old. And that, you know, to me, that really says a lot for, you know, managing a horse and knowing a horse's strengths and weaknesses and limitations, because there's a lot of money to be made. There's a lot of trophies to be won in this sport without the Kentucky Derby, without forcing your horse and forcing the issue and trying to go after the Derby with a horse who is not meant to go a mile and a quarter. So I gotta give a tip of the hat to Kirk Robinson and Steve Asmussen for managing this horse so well and pulling the plug on a potential Triple Crown Derby run after just one race as a 3-year-old, because look at the way it's paid off. And it was remarkable to watch. Those fractions, like you said, 21.97, 44.16, 108.36. You don't see horses run 108 and 1 at Saratoga. That just does not happen. And they finished up, you know, they slowed down a little bit in the last eighth, as you would expect, but not much. They finished up 121.39. So final quarter of final eighth of 13.03. And I got to give a lot of credit to Life is Good also, because it seemed like he was going to get beaten, you know, maybe a length and a half at the eighth pole. It looked like Jackie's Warrior was starting to pull away from him. He put his head down and came back after him and almost got back up. So it's a cliche, but it was truly the kind of race that did not deserve a loser. And both horses are just, you know, a pleasure to watch and will be a pleasure to watch for however long they continue to run. So we're going to get to the rest of the card, because there was so much other action that really is worth talking about. And we'll do it after this message from Keeneland.
Take part in the Keeneland November experience this fall. Entry deadline for the Keeneland November sale is Monday, August 2nd. Learn more at november.keeneland.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Spendthrift. Spendthrift, you know, had a lot of action on Saturday, as they always do. Gamine, we're going to get to her in a little bit. I know John's excited to talk about Gamine, but a daughter of Into Mischief, you know, you can't go a Saturday without a daughter or a son of Into Mischief doing something special. And she really did run well on Saturday, and she's a win machine. It's as simple as that. And then future Spendthrift Stallion, we just finished talking about, Jackie's Warrior. You know, we're already talking about what an exciting prospect he is, you know, as a sprinter, miler, stallion. He's going to be, I think, very sought after even if he retired on the spot right now, but I think he's still got a little bit more brilliance in him, and he's going to be highly sought after. But I wanted to get John's opinion on this, because it was announced last Wednesday after the show that Nona Genda, who won this year's Florida Derby, is going to retire to Spendthrift and is going to stand for $10,000. That seems like a pretty good deal for a grade one winning son of Curlin, John. What would you think as a breeder?
Yeah, no question. You know, he's being priced at a value point Obviously, they're looking to try to get as many mares to him as possible. But a son of Curlin with his resume, you know, I would think would be very intriguing for breeders at $10,000. I actually haven't personally seen him up close and personal to give you an idea of his confirmation. But, you know, obviously he did it on the racetrack. And at this stage of the game, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for pedigree, you're looking for performance, and you're looking for pricing, the three P's, as Joe Bianco likes to call them. And certainly Spendthrift is doing, you know, a very aggressive pricing model on a great horse like this.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that Spendthrift is good about is they price horses very realistic coming out of the gate with confidence that they're going to be successful and they're going to be able to raise that price over time. And if you remember, Into Mischief was had a 12,500 stud fee at the beginning, and obviously now he's in the stratosphere. But yeah, you know, as a layman, I think that seems like pretty good value for a Grade 1 winning son of Curlin. So good luck to Spendthrift with known agenda. We talked about this in the previous segment that it seems like Horse of the Year is really down to three contenders and three really worthy contenders. You know, a couple of years ago, no disrespect to Bricks and Mortar, who was a super, super nice turf horse, but it was just one of those years where it kind of felt like he won Horse of the Year by default because there wasn't a great older dirt male or female. Last year, obviously, Authentic really, really won it. But, you know, even then, like, he really just came out of nowhere, really, to take the last Derby and then ran well in the Preakness and the Classic. He was a very deserving winner, obviously. But it wasn't like he had this amazing, amazing year all the way through. He really just finished strong and took that trophy. This year, I think you have three horses who have done it. Maybe Nick's goes a little bit of an exception, but three horses basically who have done it for the whole year and have had like a real calendar of success, and especially Latruska. And, you know, she won the personal end zone on Saturday. It was a 101 buyer, one of the lower winning buyers among the Grade 1 races. I do not care what the buyer speed figure was. If you look at the time form figure, it's much higher considering the pace. But she is just one of those horses who takes every single shot and continues to find a way to hold horses up. She looked like she was going to get swallowed up by five different horses at the eighth pole, and somehow none of them even really threatened her. I think she won by like a half length or three quarters of a length, but it seemed like a pretty comfortable win. And she takes every punch. She can set fast paces and keep on going. And that to me is the mark of a true champion, a horse that, you know, we talked about it with Essential Folly. It's a little different because he's a little more versatile, but a horse that, you know, no matter the circumstance, finds a way to run their A race every time. And that's what she's done. And, you know, I thought it was a little, I didn't love that Swiss Skydiver was ridden so passively after she outbroke Latruska. Like, I get the idea that you don't want to go head to head with the favorite like that, but I thought, you know, they could have made Latruska work a little bit to get the lead. But once she did, she had to run fast. It wasn't like she had an easy lead. And like I said, just to be able to hold off challenge after challenge in the stretch, man, that is a hell of a champion. And she would be a deserving winner of Horse of the Year if she wins her last couple of races. You know, she's going to have a race, at least one, in between now and the Breeders' Cup, unlike some other horses, some other, you know, top flight horses that we won't name. She's a runner by today's standards. She's a war horse. And you just had to appreciate that performance. What did you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, again, I couldn't agree more. And when you talk about Horse of the Year, or older filly or mare of the year, it's important to recognize that this is a horse that has been going from day one. She shows up in all the right spots. She performs every time out. I'm a little bit, not quite as high on her race as you were. I didn't think it was her best race. I think she's run better races this year. But at the end of the day, it didn't matter. She got to the wire first. So she is, you know, worthy of all sorts of awards. Again, she's clinched the older filly and mare championship. That's for sure. So, you know, let's look at her future. I believe they're going to the Spinster next. And I'm even wondering, you know, this outfit, the Mexican owned horse, the Mexican based trainer, who's the king of Mexico City horse racing, Fausto Gutierrez, they've hinted that they might go in the Classic. Which could you imagine? I mean, I don't think it's going to happen at the end of the day. Could you imagine getting Petruska in the same starting gate? The Essential Quality and Nixco. I mean, that would just be absolutely a phenomenal race. So, yeah, I mean, I know the theme today is positivity and happy talk, and I'm all on board with that because, again, you know, on a great card, it was another performance from just a terrific horse. At this point, we have to say of Swiss Skydiver, she's just not the same. I mean, a lot of people said her Whitney wasn't that bad. Matter of fact, some people said it was a really good race, but she did get beat by, what, 10 lengths or something. And I know the year's been kind of a mess for her, especially with the quarantine situation later. But, you know, again, talk about admirable horses. We love Swiss Skydiver. We love everything she did last year. But she ran a kind of, no threatening fifth in this race. So, it's clear that she's not the same horse this year. And Harvey's Little Goyle, not so good.
Yeah. And Harvey's Little Goyle, you know, she's more of a turf horse than a dirt. I understand why they tried her here. But let's look at the overall, group that ran in this race. And you know, what I would call a legitimate grade one. You got Dunbar Road, who won the Alabama grade one. As time goes by, won the two grade twos. Bonnie South won the Fairgrounds Oaks, which is a grade two. Swiss Skydiver obviously won the Preakness. Royal Flag, the Shuvi, Latruska, obviously, 16 of 21. Miss Marissa, won a grade two. Harvey's Little Goyle's won a grade one. It was a stacked race. Now, were all the horses at the top of their game or running on their absolute preferred distance and course? No. Like we mentioned, Harvey's Little Goyle, probably a better turf horse. Some of these horses in here probably couldn't handle going a mile and an eighth at this level. But the bottom line is Petruska, ran everybody off their feet. And then whenever a contender was coming up to her, they just kind of let her out a notch again. And she did it. It wasn't the most explosive win, but who cares? It was a grade one win. And she hit the wire first and still ran a very credible race as far as the figures go. And now is, 16 of 21 in her career. Going back to Swiss Skydiver, I asked this question aloud to you guys, but I wonder if the Lasix issue has something to do with why she's not running as well either, because in the four races that she hasn't, on the four races where she's run without Lasix, obviously she did win the Beholder, but then she's run a third, fourth, and now off the board in this race. Prior to that, she ran 12 times and had six wins, 3 seconds and two thirds. So I wonder just aloud if it's a Lasix issue or if it's just everything that happened, being that here's a horse who danced every dance as a 3-year-old, ran in all the big races, including at the Preakness in a COVID, ravaged schedule, then, had the insult to injury of being in a quarantine barn, at Saratoga and wasn't able to run in really two of the races that they originally had on their card. And maybe it's just a combination of all those things. But nothing, to take away from Swiss Skydiver, who earned $2.2 million in her career and won the Preakness against the boys. But yeah, she's probably not the same filly that she was before. That should not take anything away from Latruska, who just dominated this, this group and really looked impressive doing it. And this is when you want these horses to kind of start peaking is, the race or two before the Breeders' Cup Series.
Yeah. And, she ran a race where you don't often see horses have to fight off basically every single other horse in the race at different points. Like, to me, that was what was impressive about her, was that she had the early challenge. She had a top of the stretch challenge, and then she had a wall of horses coming at her late, and she managed to fight everybody off. I think that was what was so impressive and why the buyer figure doesn't really mean anything to me. That was her third grade one win of the year. Like John mentioned, she's 16 for 21. She was a champion in Mexico and in her native country. And then now she's $1.7 million earner. I agree with Swiss Skydiver. She's obviously not the same filly this year. I just think it's one of those things where, fillies as they get older, sometimes just don't run the same for whatever reason. I think of, Rachel Alexandra might have lost a step late in her career. I remember her losing the Personal Ensign at a really short price. But, she's going to go down in history because she's a champion and because she beat the boys in the Preakness, much like Rachel Alexandra did. So regardless of this year, obviously has been a disappointment. I think Kenny McPeak would admit that, she did something outside the box and special last year. And I'm going to remember her 3-year-old campaign for a long time because of how aggressive Ken McPeak was with her, because of how many different racetracks she ran at, because of her running against the boys. It was just one of those years that was extremely special, and she's going to be a champion forever. So even if she retires today off a couple of disappointing races, I don't think that really takes away from her legacy at all. But yeah, Latruska is just, she's a racehorse. She's an honest 100% out and out racehorse, loves her job, loves to run. And it's a pleasure to watch her. And she's got the one up, in terms of the horse of the year. Obviously it's about, it's gonna be a hindrance to her that she's only running against Philly. So I kind of get why they're gonna run her against the boys conceivably in the classic. But she's got 3 grade one wins. Nixco only has the 2. Essential Quality only has the 2. I think those two are still ahead of her because of the fact that they're running an open company and that they have a couple of other, or at least in Essential Qualities, Casey has a couple of other grade 2 wins as well. But she's, in terms of the grade 1 standing, she's ahead of them. So, you know, she's at least in the conversation for sure. The other, you know, the other kind of viral race on Saturday was the 4-go. And I tweeted this after the race. There is always a new way to lose money at the racetrack. And that was one of those cases where if you bet Firenze Fire, he was going to win that race. You know, I don't think there's any doubt that he was going to win that race. It was a great stretch battle, but he was surging past Jaapan and then decided to try to bite him at least 7 times, like 7 or 8 times. And I got to give credit to Jaapan and Ricardo Santana because neither of them flinched. You know, they just kept their head down and kept running, and, you know, were able to hold Firenze Fire off. You know, Jose Ortiz was able to correct him eventually and push him through the wire, but it just, you know, that he lost enough momentum that he wasn't going to be able to get back up. But it was an exemplar of one of those, how it was one of those days where you just saw a little bit of everything. You saw great horses, you saw great stretch battles, you saw, you know, great returning horses, you saw the horse of the year maybe, and then you saw a horse try to bite another one 7 or 8 times in the stretch. I wonder what your guys' reaction was when you saw that, because we've seen that before, but not in a grade one race and not to that extent.
Yo, please, you didn't bet on Firenze Fire, did you?
I didn't. I told you, okay. I bet on Saturday.
Yeah, right. It was, I mean, you're not going to say like this was the best race of the day or anything like that. And matter of fact, on paper, I thought the 4-go came up one of the weaker grade ones. But, you know, for entertainment value, how can you beat that? And I agree, you see this happen from time to time, but usually once or twice. I've never seen a horse just go ballistic like that and try to go after another horse. He said 6-7 times. I don't know what it was, but Firenze Fire just woke up on the wrong side of the bed. I mean, what pissed him off?
The interesting thing was, if you remember 2 years ago, Firenze Fire, 3 years exactly. ago, Firenze Fire had that happen to him.
Yeah.
Gallant Bob, another horse tried to bite him in that race.
Right.
Weird.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, Bill, is it true that you lost your voice because you were screaming at the TV?
Yeah, I was rooting home Firenze Fire there trying to. No.
That's what I thought. That was the rumor. That was the rumor that I heard. But yeah, no, it was really interesting. And it's funny. I had to step away from my TV for this race to take a call and didn't even watch the race. And all of a sudden, like, my phone started blowing up. And I was going, oh no, my first reaction was, oh no, somebody broke down, you know, what's going on. And I turned on the TV and it was like mind blowing to me that would happen down the stretch in a grade one. And, it was kind of like, you know, Michael Jordan versus Mike Tyson, you know, in this race. I mean, it was the really elegant, you know, Jaapan that was in front. And then all of a sudden Firenze Fire, you know, it was trying to grab him by the ear. And I don't remember seeing it, certainly in a grade one and not to that extent, but I love the comment in the racing form. And I'm just going to read it. You know, Firenze Fire .. began to savage that foal badly. Coming to the 16th pole, continued to savage the opponent while the rider attempted to reach up and pull him off using the right rein, lost momentum in the process, had the jockey hand slip off the rein multiple times while trying to gather him up, was finally able to grab the rein about 40 yards from the wire, bumping at that juncture and just missed. And that actually just missed is true because the horse was going to win. But I don't know why, what got in his head. And there's photos of him with a barn cat, you know, sleeping with a barn cat and never having an issue. And, you know, that's on Twitter now. And you just don't know what goes through, you know, athletes' minds when either they're getting so built up and they're going to win or they're so frustrated that they can't get past another athlete. I who knows? I mean, you can't get into the mind of these horses sometimes, but that was an incredible feat. And you know, when you first said, you know, race of the year, I thought you were going to go to this one just because it was a stretch duel and because it was literally a tooth and nail battle. But I can see why you picked the other race. But to me, from an entertainment standpoint, this was really, an eye-opening experience and one that we'll be talking about for a really, 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 really long time.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it just exemplified that this day had everything. And yeah, maybe we do a TDN writers' room investigation to try to get to the bottom of why Firenze Fire did that. But that was same thing. I was like out at brunch, and my phone started blowing up, and everybody was tweeting about it. So it was, and when I saw it, I couldn't stop laughing. I watched the replay over and over again because it was absolutely hilarious, but not hilarious if you've had Firenze Fire at that price. But just want to wrap up the Saturday. We had two other great ones. We also had a TDN Rising Star performance out of Jack Christopher. You know, Munnings just keeps getting runner after runner after runner, year after year after year. He's just, you know, a real stalwart in the stallion industry. And you know, Jack Christopher, I thought was, honestly, I thought the most impressive two-year-old male of the meet. I know there's been some other really nice performances, but he really did it for me, lived up to the hype. But as far as the other two grade ones go, we had Gaffoe winning the Sword Dancer and Gamin winning the Ballerina. Now I'll leave all the Gamin fluffing to John. That's his department here. And just want to talk about Gaffoe real quick. Now, he was a horse that kind of got a little bit unlucky in the Manhattan. I don't think he was ever beating domestic spending, but he had kind of a right turn in the stretch that day, ended up being third. I thought the difference in that race was Joel Rosario beating Ryan Moore to the spot to be the first to go by Tribuvon, who I think he knew in his mind was probably not going to see out the mile and a half. And he and Ryan Moore on Japan were both kind of coming at the same time after Tribuvon, and Joel Rosario was aggressive, beat him to the spot, took the lead, made Ryan Moore just steady just the tiniest bit and come around on Japan. And then Japan fell a neck or so short. I think that Joel Rosario, you know, he kind of goes in spurts. I think he goes on walkabouts sometimes and isn't on his game. But when he is on his game, to me, he is one of the, if not the best, big money rider in the game. He just knows his horses. He does his homework. He's aggressive. He's a phenomenal finisher. We all know that about him. And he had a great day. We talked about his ride on Jackie's Warrior. He also got Viadera up by a nose in the Boston Spa. And then the ride on Gaffoe, I thought, like I said, made the difference in that race. And Ryan Moore is a great rider. It's nothing against him. But Joel Rosario skunked him in there and got the win because he was the better, more aggressive rider in that spot. Just some thoughts from you guys on the other grade ones.
Yeah. First of all, John, I hope these aren't fighting words, but I was not impressed with Gamin. I mean, you know, she was in a race where she could possibly lose.
No, I mean, she was good. She set the standard so high.
I agree. And, you know, so maybe we'll have to hold off that Hall of Fame induction for just, I mean, again, it's, you shouldn't be saying, oh, horseman a grade one. But for her, you know, the standard she set where she's been so electric in many of these races, I mean, again, she was in a situation where there's no way. She's the only speed in the race. She's the quality filly in there. And she was kind of just, you know, got the job done. So that was it, you know. And please forgive me, John. Don't hold this against me. And then the other thing, I'll give you an observation again about the Sword Dancer. And look, I know he got beat, but Japan ran so well and came so close to winning. And this is a grade three horse, a group three horse from Aidan O'Brien. If these horses that he's bringing over are running so well, what on earth is going to happen in the Breeders' Cup when he brings over the A team? You know, he's had a really, really good year here in the U.S. with three grade ones, almost got a fourth there with Japan. So, but yeah, Gaffoe got the job done. But I think Aidan O'Brien, once again, you know, left a message that he is not to be taken lightly this year.
Yeah, who would have thought that that I personally would be so excited about a mile and a half turf race as I was about this one. Honestly, I mean, you know, you look at this race and Gaffoe is a horse that, you know, Clement, when he came on our show a year ago, actually talked about Gaffoe and the talent that he had and the fact that he thought that he was one of the top three, then 3 year old, you know, turf horses in the country. And, you know, you have to look at, if it wasn't for a little bit of bad luck, this horse would have had a tremendous career, and already has a very good career, you know, topped off by the Sword Dancer. And interestingly enough, and I don't think this was mentioned yet, but Gaffoe, now that they put blinkers on him, is 2 for 2. he's won both races now that they put the extra equipment on and they put the blinkers on to get him a little more focused. And you say, well, you know, is he a little closer going a mile and a half marathon distance? Yeah, he was. And that makes the difference, because these races are a lot of, you know, a lot of creep and sprint, you know, and certainly this race, you know, fell right into that category, going, you know, 6 furlongs and 1:14 and 2 and a mile and a minute 39. So they were crawling in the beginning. But you're going to look at the turf marathon that's coming down, the $4 million turf race for the Breeders' Cup. And you have Gouffaut, Japan, domestic spending, Bolshoi Ballet, maybe Love is going to come in, you know, United. I mean, there's a lot of really good horses around the world that are going to be setting up for that $4 million purse. And that's going to be a really interesting and exciting race. And the other thing that I thought was interesting about the race is, you know, Japan as a horse, you know, came over here and ran a very quality second. And, you know, Bill, I don't know if you realize this, but when he won the Grade 3 at Leopardstown last time out, he carried 140 pounds. 140. I mean, you don't see that here, obviously. But how's that for a handicap where, you know, yeah, he's a legitimate Grade 1 winner in his career, but they decided to run him in a Grade 3 and they weight handicapped him to 140 pounds. So when he was riding at a, you know, carrying 120 pounds, he was probably like, this is great. This is like, you know, I got an apprentice on me again. So that was definitely the sword dancer. Gentlemen, you guys are smoking crack if you don't think that meat is enough. There's no way. Look, she not only won, which is what she was supposed to do with those odds, and she did it with a 104 buyer, which, again, that's not the be all and end all, but she did improve again. She came cross country. She literally breezed at Del Mar August 21st. I'm assuming they put her on a plane, although I don't know, because, you know, there's no, Tex Sutton doesn't have a plane right now. So maybe they vanned her all the way across country to run in this race. But either way, planes, trains, automobiles, she got here, probably only had a couple of days, and then, you know, went out and won this race pretty impressively. She's going to be 2-5 in the Filly and Mare sprint. I don't know how you can say that she's not a quality horse.
Nobody said that, John, but she's not a man of war. I mean,
putting words in my mouth. Yeah. I mean, well, the thing is, we have to balance out John's exuberance on the show, where he's already put her in the Hall of Fame.
Also awarded her the male sprinter title. So yeah, twice. It's a male sprinter title.
Not once, but twice I did. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So someone has to be the reality check for John Green when it comes to Gamine. No, listen, she ran well. She had a 104 buyer, like you said. It was the circumstance of the race where she got the easy lead and you expect her to explode away from those horses, because a horse like Lake Avenue a year ago was not supposed to be in the same picture as her. Now that's the high expectations that she set. You know, if you're like a superstar athlete and you win MVP one year, and then the next year you have a really good year, but not an MVP caliber year, you know, you're going to get criticized, because that's just the way things work in sports. And that's why, you know, that's what we do. We're talking heads. We criticize and we praise and we, you know, we hope we get it right most of the time. Listen, she's an extremely nice horse, and she's one of those few horses that, you know, cost so much at the auction and then lived up to it on the racetrack. That I think is, you know, a credit to her, because so many of those big purchases do not even come close to living up to that hype. So she's obviously a very nice horse. I'm just saying, and I think that's, you know, I think it's kind of a universal opinion that she's not quite the same filly this year as she was last year. And I think if you didn't have your Gamine colored glasses on, John, you would be able to figure that out. But no, she's obviously super nice. I wanted to, because we've been going on and on about the weekend, as we should. It was a phenomenal weekend. Like I said, it was a type of day that reminded you why you love racing, because there's so many times that we get on this show and we just, you know, there's so much bad news and so much controversy, and you smack your head and think, like, why is this isn't even worth it? Like, why are we such advocates for this sport? Saturday is why we're advocates for this sport, because it was an absolutely magical, scintillating day of races at Saratoga. Just two other horses I wanted to mention before we wrap up the recap. I thought on Friday and the New York Red Stakes Day, there was a lot of good action, but I thought American Revolution was very, very impressive for Todd Pletcher and WinStar in winning the Albany. That was kind of the centerpiece of the New York Bred Showcase day. He got a 98 buyer. He just has this really long, powerful stride. And it was only his fourth career start. I think that that's why they didn't go into Travers, because, you know, just take such a quality out of it. I thought otherwise he made sense in the Travers. But I think, in the end, they did the right thing. They're bringing him along a little bit slowly. He's very interesting. And then the great return of Medina Spirit. Medina Spirit came back to the racetrack in the Shared Belief. He won. He got a 100 buyer. I know Bill wants to talk a little bit about Medina Spirit, because it's been so long. It's been so long since we've been able to talk about Bob Baffert and Medina Spirit. Bill?
Yeah, and we can actually talk about Medina Spirit in a positive way, as, again, the theme of this show is happy talk. But normally you wouldn't get that excited about a horse winning the Shared Belief Stakes, non-graded, et cetera. But he had to beat a grade one winner, a real horse in Rock Your World, the Santa Anita Derby winner. So all things considered, I'm sure Baffert is very happy with that performance, as it's going to move him forward. I would assume he's going to go in the Pennsylvania Derby next. Yeah, he could be in the mix for the Breeders' Cup Classic as well. I don't think he would get any votes no matter what happened for Horse of the Year, because essentially everybody knows his Derby is someday going to be taken away from him. But, definitely a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and like you said, it adds a lot of intrigue to an already very, very intriguing Breeders' Cup Classic potentially. And so we have a lot to look forward to in the fall, but it was good. It was good to get that day on Saturday to really appreciate it. And it was good to break it all down with you guys. The TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Woodford Thoroughbreds. Welcome, Woodford, back to the show. One misconception about Woodford is that they only break and train two-year-old sales prospects, but 65% of their business is breaking and training for clients to go to the races. Graduates of this program include 2020 Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf winner Fire at Will, plus 4 2-year-old maiden special weight winners for Tom Amos at this year's Saratoga meet. He's had a great meet. Their trainer, John Gleason, will be on site at the Keeneland September sale. If buyers would like to discuss sending a horse to Woodford for the races or for the 2-year-old sales, Woodford bred yearling sales grad Tiz a Magician, who we've mentioned before, who's second in the Pacific Classic, will be pointing for the Grade 1 Breeders' Cup Classic. Obviously going to be a terrific race. And Woodford sends their congratulations to the connections of My Racehorse and Spendthrift Farm. And Woodford has 45 yearlings entered at the upcoming Keeneland September sale with sire power like Into Mischief, Quality Road, Candy Ride, up-and-coming sires like Nyquist and Gunrunner, plus freshman sires Justify, City of Light, Good Magic, and more. I know John's been studying the Keeneland September catalog. What do you have to say about the Woodford consignment, John?
There were so many good horses they have in their consignment, but there are two that I already earmarked and asked our shortlister to take extra special consideration to, and that's Hip 352, Spikestown filly out of Dynazapper. Is a full sister to Coppertown, who was second in the House Hope. But, from a great female family, you look at it and you say, Dinah Zapper, who was a stake winner in her own right, is a daughter of Go Zapper, second to Emperor Dynamite, who was a daughter of Broadbrush. So you look at, Broadbrush and Go Zapper, and you say, distance. Well, what's the best thing to do? Read it to speed. Spikestown, it's already worked once before. So I'm curious to see how that filly looks physically. I'm excited about her pedigree. And then probably, one of the most exciting pedigrees that I, turned a page over on in book two was Hip 778, who's a Candy Ride colt that Woodford is selling for WinStar Farm. And the colt is out of a Tisnow mare. So again, can probably go run all day long. But is a half to Bye Bye Hong Kong, who was a grade three placed horse, and two other stake winners. So already in the first dam, that colt has, has a couple of really good siblings, half siblings that have already shown it on the racetrack. So I'm curious to see not only on the Spikestown filly, but also this Candy Ride colt. And hopefully we'll have a reason to bid on both of them.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, again, great sponsorship crossover. We get the Green Group to buy one of the Woodford horses. But yeah, welcome to Woodford. It's been a great summer for them. And I know that they're really gearing up for this Keeneland September sale. So good luck to you guys in the Keeneland September sale. So friend of the show, Pat Cummings, and the TIF published a recent blog post on fixed odds wagering and talking about how it's a kind of a once in a generation opportunity for racing. And we had bet makers Dallas Baker on the show about a month or two ago to talk about them implementing fixed odds wagering at Monmouth Park. That's been going on for a little bit yet. So far, as far as I know, we don't have data on whether or not it's been popular I am all for fixed odds wagering. I think, you know, the more alternatives you give, the better. That's the way to go. And I think it's paramutual wagering can be very frustrating. But I just wanted to bring up this point. I wonder if Bill has any thoughts on this. You know, we had David O'Rourke on when we were up in Saratoga, and we talked a little bit with him about him limiting the computer wagerers. And if you notice at Saratoga, there haven't been those steep late odds drops, you know, when the horses seemingly come out of the gate, which I think has been good. You know, I think you have a reasonable expectation now that the price that you get when the horse is loading into the gate is, you know, more or less the price that you're going to get when the horse comes out of the gate. So I wonder if that maybe negates a little bit the impetus for fixed odds wagering to kind of, you know, sweep the country and become the new standard. What are your thoughts on that, Bill? Do you think these, you know, kind of eliminating or at least mitigating these late odds drops, you know, does that at all take the steam out of the push for fixed odds wagering?
No, Joe, I don't think it does, because I think that's only a very small segment of the whole picture of what fixed odds wagering may mean. And, you know, what David O'Rourke and Pat Cummings and some other people have latched on to now is, how do we get the sports better to get involved in horse racing? And right now, you can't. First of all, I mean, people are too, you know, focused on, you know, the Jets plus 3.5 on Sunday, et cetera. And they really don't know that horse racing exists. And on their betting websites, where they use FanDuel or whomever, or DraftKings, et cetera, you literally have, you know, darts. You can bet on darts somewhere. Two guys in a pub somewhere in Ireland throwing darts at a thing. You can bet on that. Horse racing is the only sport out there that is not in this universe. Now, if you put sports betting up there, you can't do it paramutually. It wouldn't work. You'd have to do it with fixed odds. So, you know, again, you look at John's favorite horse, Benin. She went off at what, 1-5, paid $2.70. She likely would have been a fixed odds prospect of what you would have had to bet, like minus 300, something like that. You bet 300 to win 100. So the sports bettor will understand that. And it gives them an opportunity to bet on horse racing. Now, are you going to get everybody and their brother to say, okay, I just won my bet on the 49ers and the 4 o'clock games are over. I'm going to bet fixed odds on the ninth race at Mountaineer Park. You know, probably not, but it gives them a chance. It gives horse racing a chance to get these people coming in. Sports betting is just taken off with reckless abandon. It is the biggest thing in the world in the United States, and it's only going to get bigger. And if horse racing gets left behind in this, they're in big trouble. Fixed odds wagering is the way to become part of the equation with this.
I think you're looking at a society that has embraced the idea of gambling and gambling in the, you know, on their phone and doing it pretty much on anything. And you know, there's an old saying, you know, shoot or shoot. And there's I'm going to start a new saying, gamblers bet. I mean, that's just, they're going to bet on whatever they can. And I think it showed during COVID when all the major sports were not participating. And horse racing was really the only game in town. And we had spikes and we had, you know, increases in overall handle and increases in betting and wagering, you know, across the board. So it is on people's radars. It's not necessarily their first choice, I think, to the average gambler. It's not their first choice is to go and look up a race, whether it's at Saratoga or Mountaineer Park or anywhere in between. But if it's the only game in town, and there's only one football game left on Sunday night, and they can cross promote it with, you know, with some night racing somewhere to be able to get themselves out of a hole, people are going to bet on it because they're going to see that that's a way that they can get their lunch money back. So I think that it's good that we're starting to have these conversations and going in that direction. I know that I've already sat in on a couple of horsemen's meetings with the fixed odds, you know, wagering groups, and they really feel like that they're going to get they keep talking about a 10% sliver in the overall wagering world. If they can get that, then then horse racing is going to be back on the good side of the ledger.
Yeah, I mean, it really just goes a long way in terms of modernizing the sport and the way the sport is bet, because you know, you go overseas, fixed odds wagering is more or less the standard. There are parimutuel pools, but most people are going to make their bets with a bookmaker of some sort. And I think that, you know, it just, the more options that you give the racing better, I think the better it is for them. I think it's going to take a little bit to catch on. Like I said, I would love to see data from this pilot program at Monmouth to see like what it handles compared to the parimutuel pools, because I think horse players in general are kind of slow to adapt to these kind of things. So I think that, that'll be interesting to see over time. But I agree that it's going to be part, at least, of the future, you know, smorgasbord of options for bettors and for horse bettors. The odds drops thing was a huge thing for me. And I was just wondering if that mitigated the support for fixed odds. But I think, like you guys are saying, it ties into the sports betting platforms much better and easier than the parimutuel stuff does. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about sports betting and its future relative to racing. Owning graded stakes winners like Decorated Invader and First Captain is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtd.com. Mention First Captain. He's going to run in the Pennsylvania Derby. West Point's also going to have some action closing weekend at Saratoga in the Spinaway with Sequist, daughter of Nyquist. And then County Final, John, you said is running soon?
Yeah, County Final is going to run in the Franklin Simpson Stake at Kentucky Downs. So we can ask our guests of the week about those races as well.
Yeah, a lot of money up for grabs at Kentucky Downs. And also Flightline, $1 million yearling purchase and a TDN Rising Star. He was the XBTV work of the day on Monday, went 5 furlongs and 59-3. I think we're all very excited to see Flightline back on the track. He was, you know, honestly, maybe the most impressive maiden winner of the entire year. So we're very excited to see what he does next. So we touched on this a little bit in the previous segment, but I feel like we need our own segment to talk about sports betting because we haven't really discussed it that much on the show. We've talked about it a little bit with some guests, but amongst ourselves, we haven't really talked about it that much. And whether or not sports betting is going to be a good thing for racing in terms of, you know, bringing new people into the game, or if it's just going to overwhelm horse racing and, you know, we're kind of going to be kicked to the side even a little bit more than we already are. In the betting landscape, I think it can be a good thing, a major good thing, honestly, if racing is able to get onto the same platforms and promote itself alongside the other more mainstream sports. And I think the good news is that a lot of decision makers in racing, we talked about David O'Rourke, you know, have expressed that they get this and they know how important it is for us to be alongside of the other sports. And it goes back a little bit to the fixed odds discussion. And that's where I think it can most come in handy in terms of letting people set cross sport parlay bets at certain prices at any time, where it kind of standardizes racing with the other sports in terms of how it's priced. And I think that sports betting provides racing the easiest opportunity, if we're able to successfully partner and cross promote with sports books, to bring existing bettors into the fold with just the click of a button, instead of, you know, what racing has been doing for years, which is a much taller task, is trying to create entirely new bettors, you know, with marketing campaigns or trying to get new people out to the track. I think the sport should continue to do that stuff, but it's a tall order to just out of thin air create new horse bettors. You know, I thought for a while that we could have some kind of cross promotion with poker bettors, because I know a lot of people, or some people at least, that bet poker will also bet the horses. That's very hard. I think the sports books are the way to go to kind of glom onto that. And I think that'll be the easiest, not saying easy, but the easiest avenue to create new horse bettors. What do you guys say?
Well, Joe, as we mentioned earlier, the fixed odds betting gives horse racing a chance to become involved in the sports betting world and perhaps piggyback off of it. But I know the theme of the show is happy talk, and I'm going to go against it. I think by and large, you have to look at sports betting as something that's going to be potentially have a big negative impact on horse racing. Because if you look at it from, you know, the beginning of the time, whenever the, you know, internet started, the only online legal wager you could make was a horse bet. Just like before lotteries and casinos spread, the only wager you could make legally in this whole country was a horse racing bet. So horse racing had this monopoly on online wagering. And now it's been totally taken away. The, you know, it's, you go state by state. I believe sports betting is illegal in like 20 states right now. When it's all said and done, it'll be legal in every place, but, you know, weird places like Utah and stuff like that. How can horse racing compete with a form of a wagering on sports that are much more popular than horse racing? The other thing I worry about, and Joe, you would be a good one to answer this because you're the youngest one among the crew, that if you get the guy that just graduated from college, has his first job, has a little bit of disposable income, and he's got like that gambling bug, that gambling gene, I think there, you had a chance to get that person into horse racing, even if they're not a big fan. You know, they'll hear about it. Oh, I'm going to open up a TVG account or something like that. I'm going to give it a chance. I don't see, you know, this, and horse racing has had a difficult time attracting younger generations as it is. I think sports betting is going to make it all that much harder to get the 23-year-old who likes to gamble on horse racing when they have the alternative of betting on the Jets plus 3.5.
If you get a plus 5, week one, I think that's actually the right line. So much of it is going to depend on how much cross promotion and cross marketing you can get, which is not a guarantee because, you know, I think racing needs the sports books a hell of a lot more than the sports books need racing. So that, you know, I think that's that is really the crux of the issue. But I agree that, you know, it doesn't bode well that racing did have this monopoly on online wagering for so long and didn't really capitalize on it in terms of growing the business. I think that that's a problem and that's kind of a bad harbinger for the future. But I will say that sports betting has, you know, it is legal in a lot of places now. It's no longer, I know it's not legal everywhere, but it's no longer just Nevada. You know, there are a lot of places where you can still bet, or you can now bet, at least online betting sports. And I don't think that racing's handle has noticeably decreased or taken a hit from that. So I don't know that it's going to be this kind of disaster and they're just going to crush us. But I think a lot of it depends on what kind of partnerships we can create with sports books where, I don't know, maybe you get like a little bonus or something if you throw a racing bet into a parlay, just something, some kind of incentive to get people to check it out. Because I still do think that if you get people in the door, they generally have a positive experience and like it and we'll try to bet it again. It's about getting that point of entry for people. And it doesn't happen enough. And it really hasn't happened enough for a long time now. So I just think that this is maybe the last chance that racing has, if it's able to successfully integrate into sports books, maybe the last chance that we have to get a significant new customer base. Whether or not that's going to work out, you know, we're going to have to see. But I choose to look at it, not just because I'm Mr. Positive today. I choose to look at it more as an opportunity, at least until I'm proven wrong. We're going to see, you know, it's like you said, it's going to be legal everywhere eventually, but it's going to take a couple of years, I think, for that to happen, if not a decade or more. I think these things move pretty slowly. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I think it's an opportunity, but I agree with Bill about the potential pitfalls as well. Joining the West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from our friends at West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. Do you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program? Give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. So some Legacy news this week. Sleepy Eyes Todd, who was a 2016 Keeneland November Legacy grad, was second to Art Collector in the Charlestown Classic, the Grade 2 Charlestown Classic on Friday night, and became the third Legacy grad to earn over $2 million. That's pretty damn good. And Legacy has a major consignment coming up at the Keeneland September sale, as you would expect. They have 70 yearlings entered, and the list includes prospects like Nyquist, American Pharaoh, and Arrogate, plus freshman sires, popular freshman sires, like Mendelssohn, City of Light, Army Mule, and more. Just want to run down some of what we got going on this weekend. Obviously, it's going to be hard to top Traverse Day, but we do have a good weekend of racing coming up. Don't know where Labor Day came from. Feels like this summer went by in the snap of a finger. But we have a big Labor Day weekend, mainly at Saratoga and Del Mar. And then, of course, starting Monday, we have Kentucky Downs. We're going to talk to Ron Winchell in a little bit about that meet. It's a very, very exciting meet. I know John's got some interest there. A lot of money up for grabs. Big fields, great betting product. But this weekend, it's all about Saratoga and Del Mar. Saratoga on Saturday has four graded stakes, two grade ones, the Jockey Club Gold Cup and the Flower Bowl. I actually didn't realize that they moved the Flower Bowl as well. I knew they moved the Jockey Club Gold Cup up to Saratoga this year, but the Flower Bowl used to be a mile and a quarter turf race at Belmont. Now it's going to be a mile and 3/8 on the Saratoga turf course. And I think the headliner there is Warlike Goddess, who we saw win the Glens Falls extremely impressively early in the meet. It looks like she's going to come back at the Flower Bowl. So that's going to be very exciting. And the Spinaway, we have the Spinaway on Sunday. We have the Hopeful, the Run Happy Hopeful on Monday. So the first two grade ones for two-year-olds. We also have the Del Mar Debutante and the Run Happy Del Mar Futurity. So four grade ones total for two-year-olds on the weekend. I don't know whether it makes a lot of sense to have four grade ones on a single weekend, but we'll put that aside. They're probably all going to get pretty nice races or pretty nice horses. So a lot to look forward to there. We got the Jockey Club Gold Cup, as I said. The Bernard Baruch is over the weekend, a grade two on turf at Saratoga. Just to run down some of the horses that we might see over the weekend, you know, the Jockey Club Gold Cup horse that I'm very, very excited to see is Forza Di Oro, who was a very nice horse who I've been high on for a long time for Bill Mott. He won the Discovery really impressively last year and then was off for, I think, 7 or 8 months, came back with a really nice allowance win earlier in the meet at Saratoga. This is going to be the first real acid test for him in a grade one. It looks like Max Player is going to be in there, Happy Saver as well, and By My Standards, Night Ops for Brad Cox. So this is going to be the first big test for Forza Di Oro, at least as a four-year-old. So that is something that I'm really interested in. We also have the Prioress, which is a grade two for female sprinters going 6 furlongs at Saratoga. We got the Saranac too for grade three. For three-year-olds on the grass, the John C. Mabee Stakes at Del Mar is a grade two. For the Del Mar Debutante, just looking at some of the probables here, looks like Bob Baffert's going to have a couple. Grace Adler, Dance to the Music, horse named Very Scary for Doug O'Neill. Phil D'Amato's going to have Elm Drive in there. Dance to the Music is Mark Glad. Bob Baffert's going to have Ida and Grace Adler. And the Spinaway, it looks like Sequist, who we mentioned for West Point, is going to be in there for Dallas Stewart. Sue Ellen Mishkin, nice Seinfeld reference, for Jorge Abreu, who was impressive earlier in the meet. Pretty Birdie, who won the Schuylerville on opening day. You're going to see her back in there. Ben Bang, who was a very nice looking horse for Jonathan Thomas. Echo Zulu, who was a TDN rising star for Steve Asmussen, daughter of Gunrunner. Del Mar Futurity looks like it's going to get a short field. Papa Cap for Mark Cassie, who won the Best Pal, is in there. Looks like Steve Asmussen is going to ship American Experiment across the country to run in there. And the Hopeful, we've got High Oak, who was super impressive in the Saratoga Special, and Wit, who was super impressive in the Sanford. So it looks like we're going to have a clash of some pretty nice horses in those races. But I know John's got some interest this weekend and Monday and at Kentucky Downs. So I'll let him plug some of his runners so you guys can watch him root, like I always do.
Well, thanks, Joe. I appreciate that.
That's our sarcastic. That's the way it sounds sarcastic, but I do root for yours.
No, I know. I appreciate that. And I do get texts from you, after they run, either saying congratulations or, you know, what the hell are you
doing?
What a rat. Exactly. So, you know, so I'm used to it. It's like you don't even do the full text anymore. It's if you put a number one, it means congratulations. You put a number two, it means what a rat. So I get it.
If I put a little like puff cloud, that's the best you can get, because that means the horse was fast.
That means you were smoking. Oh,
well, yes. I was also high while I was texting you, but
you're texting me, right? Okay,
in
good.
That case, it means the horse is really fast.
When there's a puff of smoke and a pretzel afterwards, doesn't that usually mean that? Anyway,
all right, go ahead, John.
We're off on a tangent again. Go figure on our ultimate positive, happy sale day at the TDN show. Anyway, just a couple of quickies. Earthstrike is going to be running in the Dueling Grounds Oaks on the 5th. over at Kentucky Downs. We have On Thin Ice, who won first time out very impressively. He's undefeated. He'll be running in the More Than Ready Juvenile, also at Kentucky Downs. And then fan favorite and friend of the show, Prudent Strategies, will be running in the Red Bank, which will actually be the first race that we're running at Monmouth Park the whole season. And Jose Ferrer will be riding him, who won on Helium for the Tampa Bay Derby. And then finally, I want to wish a little bit of luck to our friends at Judmont, who bought Amendment 19 from us specifically to run in the Prior S at Saratoga. So nothing but the best wishes, you know, for that filly and in that program. And it should be a really exciting racing weekend, not only for DJ Stable in the small microcosm, but overall in racing. It's not going to be quite the racing weekend it was last weekend, but at this point, you get half a dozen grade ones on any given weekend. It's a good weekend for racing.
Yeah, and it's going to be a celebratory weekend in general with Labor Day. It's been a fun summer. It's always a nice relief for us at the TDN because, you know, especially with Del Mar running late, it's a lot of work throughout the summer. You know, we enjoy it. We're passionate about it, but it's always a nice little relief to get into the fall. Although the Keeneland September sale, a lot of work too. But so maybe after Keeneland September, we can take a breath at least until the Breeders' Cup. But yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be really nice to see the 2-year-olds too, because, you know, that's kind of where the focus goes this weekend. And then I feel like leading up to the Breeders' Cup, you start dreaming a little bit about those Derby and Oaks horses for next year. And I think this weekend will really, you know, show who's at that top level. It's the cream of the crop, at least in this early stage. So that's really exciting. And like I said, Kentucky Downs is very exciting as well. And in the Red Bank Stakes, we have two interests because Red Bank is the home of the TDN and it's the home of our podcast studio, which we'll be back in next week. So we have, maybe John will be there to present the trophy to himself if Proven Strategies wins. I think that'll be a nice synergy there. But yeah, great weekend of racing, 2-year-olds in particular. We'll be back next week to wrap it all up and break it down. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled this week to bring on a Winchell Thoroughbreds and the owner of Kentucky Downs, Ron Winchell. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
We're super glad to have you, and it's timely because Kentucky Downs opens up next Monday. We're all very excited about it. I think it's a great meet for the bettors, a lot of money for the owners as well. Can you just talk about what you're particularly excited about this year and what maybe is new to the meet that you want people to hear about?
I think every year we try to just elevate the experience. I think this year is going to be an elevated experience for horsemen and guests that come and options that they have. I think, previous years, we took over the property in 2019. It was really like a country meet. It's basically, you're out in the grass and, we had one little tent. And then the next year we added, kind of another tent and then some like indoor, outdoor, a little air conditioning because it gets a little warm that time of year sometimes. And then this year we've got a tent that was actually, that we purchased. It was at the Breeders' Cup. It's a kind of a glass enclosure. And it's fully air conditioned. And so guest experience, they have a lot better options. But we're still trying to keep that country kind of feel to it as well. So it's a little bit of the mixture of both. And an added day as well in racing from, we got 6 days this year. Next year, we're going to try to get 7. So,
Ron, thanks for joining us. And you see most racetracks around the country that are affiliated with some sort of gaming. The gaming comes first and horse racing comes maybe sometimes not even second, comes third, fourth, fifth. That has never been, even with the people that own the track before you guys, it's never been the attitude at Kentucky Downs. You've marketed the racing, you've increased purses, you've fought to get increases in the graded stakes. So why is the mentality among you and the ownership that, you know, racing matters at Kentucky Downs rather than just kind of going through the motions with it?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is, you know, obviously I'm heavily involved in horse racing, so you don't have ownership that's segregated from actually horse racing, which sometimes happens in other states especially. But, you know, our meet is so unique with, you know, 6 days and the purse levels. You know, I think we have 16 stake races over 6 days and, you know, $3 million races. That really, it turns into this kind of this cool little boutique meet, and it's actually fun, and we do well on it, and we don't lose money, where maybe a lot of locations, it's not the same, and they lose money, and they don't have that tie to horse racing. So they really try to make it as minimum as they can, and we're kind of on the opposite. We're just like, let's spend more money, let's make it even better every year, and hopefully grow it into something bigger and better all the time. And that's kind of the focus we have when it comes to racing.
And Ron, as the fellow racehorse owner, I applaud, you know, not only the boutique meet and the fact that you make it very easy for us as owners to be involved, but also that the turf course is always in such good shape and is, you know, kind of an odd shape and undulating. We're actually bringing in some European horses that we bought over the past year to run on that turf course because it reminds us of the way that some of the turf courses are cut in Europe. Tell us a little bit about the uniqueness of the course itself, and the shape of the course.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, the uniqueness is something that, you know, a lot of people commented on it because it's kind of, if you look at the top of the backstretch or whatever, it's kind of got this bulb that comes out. And what I really love about it is when you look at how the jockeys, you know, it's unlike traditional horse racing where it's that oval in you know, the U.S. So the jockeys actually, when they come out, they start on the right rail and they try to game the system and come over on the turn when they approach the turn. And come over and time it so they get the least amount of distance. And it just creates a little more out of a sport into it. And yeah, it's kind of cool to watch when you see it, how they you know, the guys that have been there before kind of have their thought of how it plays. And the guys that are racing there for the first time kind of are like trying to feel it out. And so I just think it's unique. It's something different. It's, the grass, we try to keep it in the best shape. We're always dependent on the weather. You know, I was crossing my fingers with this hurricane. It's like, if this happened next week, we'd be in deep trouble. But, you know, we're always faced with that every year because we have such a short meet that we can't move it around too much. And if you get, you know, a big weather pattern like that, really going to, you know, disturb what we do. So luckily, you know, I'm going to knock on wood, I think the timing's great. The turf's going to be in great shape because of the rain. And hopefully it dries out. It just becomes a really nice racing surface for everybody.
I wanted to ask about Steve Asmussen and him breaking that record, because I think that you guys have, Winchell Thoroughbreds has been synonymous with Steve Asmussen and his success in the past couple of decades. It was really fitting, I thought, for him to break that record with a Winchell horse. Stellar Tap was the name of the horse who got it done. Can you just talk about what you felt and how important that was for you to be part of that and what it meant to you and to the whole team?
Right. So, you know, the couple weeks coming up to it, you know, you're kind of like monitoring and going, all right, well, you know, he's going to break the record. It's only a matter of time. And it's like, we kept thinking, oh, well, it'd be really cool if you, like, you know, actually we're saying it'd be really cool if you did with Silver State that we had running the Whitney. Of course, you know, you'd still have to win the Whitney to get that done. But, you know, and it just happened to happen on the same day, which was really cool. And happened to happen on the race that we had a starter in. So it just felt like it was just meant to be almost. You know, we were really hoping that it would be like one of our horses and him. And so it turned out to be great. It's, you know, amazing accomplishment for him. You know, the stuff he does and the amount of starters he's had and, you know, the fact that he's still pretty young and that record's just going to keep going and going. It's going to be hard to beat for someone else.
And Ron, back to Kentucky Downs. And when you look at it, the format obviously works very well, but you only have 6 days of racing. And, you know, I'm not saying Kentucky Downs should ever have a 20-day meet. I think that would spoil the uniqueness and the essence of Kentucky Downs. But why not 8 days? Why not 9 days? You know, any plans to try to do that in the future?
Right. So next year we're submitting for 7 days. We're always a little subject to the calendar because, you know, you got Ellis Park on one end and, you got other tracks. And so it really depends on how it plays out. Like this year, it kind of got a shortened calendar, the way that the days laid out and the weekends laid out in September. And so we're always going to be limited from that perspective. You know, at some point we might want to do a day you know, maybe in May or something, that, you know, we're trying to focus on maybe doing something, you know, hopefully with a little European flair to it, to attract some European horses. So there is some potential to do some stuff going forward that maybe is unique and separate it and not get too many days, like you said. Because I agree, like, what makes it nice is, like, it's a boutique meet. So, you know, it's pretty short. And, you know, usually it's over a couple weekends. And that kind of makes it special. You're not like, oh, it's just another day at Kentucky Downs. Every day is special when you have that few days.
And Ron, I want to shift gears to one of your top horses that you guys have campaigned, and that's Gun Runner. And, you know, we kind of forget sometimes that the horse made, you know, almost $14 million and basically ran in every big race against every horse, top horse of his class. And you know, was horse of the year, champion, older dirt horse. I mean, just did everything that a horse can do. And now in his first crop of you know, foals, it looks like his babies are also having some really early success. You've actually had a couple that have won first time out. I know Mark Cassie has one on the West Coast that he's very excited about. And it looks like the Gunrunner foals themselves are even more precocious than Papa Gunrunner was. You know, give us an idea of, you know, who Gunrunner was and what he meant to you, and also, you know, what you're seeing in his foals.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people don't realize is we particularly started him later just because we felt like he was going to get better as he got older, which he did. But he was incredibly fast. And I think because we didn't run him at 6 furlongs and short distances, people really look at him and go, oh, no, they're not going to make 2-year-olds. Like, they're only going to be later. They're going to be 3-year-olds. But really, yeah, when you talk to, like, especially when you talk to, like, Steve Atkinson, he's like, no, Gunrunner was, like, seriously fast. So, you know, they're capable of winning races on, you know, 6 furlongs. And I think that's what you're seeing. Although all the ones that we have, they're winning right now. They really want to go longer. And so it you know, makes us super excited. Like, okay, now we're winning at, you know, these short distances. They want to go longer. And of course, we've kind of pushed that envelope a little bit to kind of show everybody, look, these guys can really run. And they've proven to do that. And, you know, I couldn't be more excited to see what the, you know, the next phase is. This weekend coming up, we're going to have, you know, Gunrunners. You know, basically we got, you know, one running in the Hopeful, the Spinaway. I think we're looking at one maybe in the Sapling for that we own. And then you got the ones, I think, you know, down at Del Mar. I think there's probably 2 going to run in the Del Mar Futurity. So really, this weekend is going to be a pretty defining moment, I think, to see what he does and taking the next step. But I couldn't be more excited. Gunrunner is, like, obviously my favorite topic now. It used to be Tappet, but now it's Gunrunner. But and Tappet, of course, you know, what a stellar year he's having. So it's great.
No question. When you could start off any conversation with, well, my 2 best horses were Tappet and Gunrunner, I think you got a leg up on the majority of the industry. another question.
When you combine those, it's even better, because that's what we've done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. Breed the best of the best and hope for the rest. Right. Ron, my other question is, you know, with a horse like Gunrunner, when you were getting ready to stand him at stud, I'm sure every farm in Kentucky, in the world for that matter, was knocking at your door and sending you inquiries about him. Why 3 Chimneys? You know, is it because they're kind of a boutique farm, like you have a boutique meet at Kentucky Downs, or what drew you to 3 Chimneys to stand him at stud there?
That's a really easy answer, actually, because I was partnering with them. They owned half of them. They actually bred them, and then you know, in Solitary Oblo, he was just taking over the 3 Chimneys, I think, when that horse was being born. And so they put him in a sale, and we came along and just decided that let's partner up on him instead of us trying to just buy him wholly. And they've been a great partner, and I think they've done a phenomenal job. And I think, you know, it's just, you know, their history there is great. Everybody that's involved is, you know, great people, and they all do a great job. So this whole partnership has worked out great. You know, a lot of times when you have a successful partnership, you know, we've seen it in the past, and, you know, other horses, where I'm not going to name them, but, you know, the partnership kind of starts to fray and there's issues and they kind of inter fighting. That's never happened in our partnership. So it's been great to have a partner, you know, all the way through, even to standing him as a stud, and everybody's happy and everybody's been doing a great job. So that's how he ended up at 3 Chimneys, and we're really happy.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously off to a phenomenal start. I wanted to ask about maybe one of the horses that puts you guys on the map on a national stage in Summerlee, who won the 2005 Kentucky Oaks, which was a $410,000 purchase at Keeneland September. And you guys later sold her for $3.3 million to Windstar. She died earlier this year of colic. Can you just talk about what she meant to you, not only winning the Oaks, but kind of establishing you guys and Steve Atkinson on that big stage?
Right. I mean, you know, one unique thing about her is she came along when, you know, my dad had passed away, and Tappet was like the last horse we actually purchased together. And so, you know, she was kind of the follow up, and he was, you know, he did great on the racetrack and was kind of important. And I really thought actually he was going to win the Derby because my dad had chased it for like 50 years and never was able to win the Derby. And it's like, you know, the last horse he buys and he passed away. And it's like, oh, that's the one that wins. That happened. But you know, the next, I think it was either year, the next year, or the following year, I'm at the September sale and, you know, end up purchasing Summerlee. And it was kind of really a nice follow up from, you know, coming off of like the success of Tappet and, you know, being, you know, pretty much out there by myself doing it without my dad anymore. And so, yeah, I bought her. I think we paid like $400,000 for her, which is pretty good at the time for what I was buying. And then, the Oaks is another race. Like, you chase the Derby, you chase the Oaks. And so for her to kind of pull through and do that in the time of my life when, you know, you're just kind of, I don't want to say just starting out, but it's kind of starting out solo, if you will. And so it was really kind of a monumental moment. You know, my mom was there. It was great. You know, just kind of a really great family event, pull everything together.
Ron, thank you so much for coming on. We're really looking forward to the Kentucky Downs meet. You guys have done a great job improving it every single year. Thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Ray.
All right. Good luck, Ron. Thanks.
Great job, Ron. Thank you.
Appreciate it. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Ron Winchell will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So that's going to do it for this week's very positive edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland September yearling sale right around the corner starts Monday, September 13th. You can learn more and see the catalog at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Ron Winchell, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you next week back in the studio.